Welcome, everybody. This is Jim Breeling. Glad to have you all listening in tonight. We're really honored tonight. We have one of the bright young psychiatrists in the country who, with multiple interests across the psychiatric spectrum, has, with the help of Charlie Schultz, who's been a long-time schizophrenia researcher, but also with a long and enduring interest in borderline personality, got our speaker involved with borderline, and she has multiple grants. To tell you, she graduated from the medical school at the University of Minnesota and has stayed on, which is a ringing endorsement, and she came there in 2008, and just 2 years later, she received a K award from the National Institute of Mental Health, and these are very, very competitive awards for investigators, young investigators, mid-level investigators, and it's as much as anything is a tremendous vote of confidence in this very stiff competition that the reviewers felt that this was a person of just outstanding potential for a research career so that the K grant would support the bulk of their time for up to 5 years to allow them to really lay the base for a very influential and productive research program. And several years later, she added on a R21, which is a smaller grant that, for an interesting idea, gives the investigator support to flesh out data and to lay a base for a larger grant. So this is very thrilling, and I want to stop here because if you glance at the slides, we've got a very meaty presentation. I want to remind you, if you have questions along the way, either something that's not clear in the slide or the presentation or about the topic, to send your question to neabpd@aol.com so we can work them in and get them answered and be responsive to you. And with that, let me stop because I want to get out of the way of our outstanding speaker.
Thank you so much, Jim. I really appreciate your kind words and makes me feel more confident about the talk. I'm Katie Cullen at the University of Minnesota, and the two co-authors that have contributed to this presentation are Mindy Westland and Anna Bortnova, who are both fantastic young ladies working in our research group. I'm going to be speaking to you about the neurobiology, my work related to the neurobiology of non-suicidal self-injury in adolescence. I'll shorten it and refer to it as NSSI. It's a topic that's relevant. I know this is a borderline personality disorder audience, and it's relevant to borderline personality disorder, but it's also a behavior that cuts across diagnoses, and that's something I'll be talking about. I don't have any... Oh, and Perry wanted me to say that the slides are a little bit modified from the ones that were sent out in the email earlier this week, but the new set is now posted on the homepage in the right-hand column, second post down. So the overview of the talk today is that I'll start out with just discussing the problem of NSSI in adolescence, talk about some of the previous work in looking at neurobiology, and our approach, try to explain our approach with conceptualizing brain-behavior relationships, trying to draw on the recent NIH initiative, Research Domains Criteria Initiative, to look at domains as opposed to categorical illnesses. I'll share with you some previous work that we've done with the neuroimaging methods that kind of prompted us to propose these methods in the current population, and just share with you our current studies in adolescents with NSSI. So one is a cross-sectional neuroimaging study that's supported by the NIH R21 that Jim mentioned. And then we're also conducting a pilot treatment study that I'll explain to you briefly. And then at the end, I'll emphasize the very preliminary results. So non-suicidal self-injury, or NSSI, is defined as the deliberate and direct destruction of or alteration of body tissue without conscious suicidal intent, but resulting in injury severe enough for tissue damage to occur. So recent papers in recent years have tons of papers in recent years have been reporting on prevalence rates around the world, and a recent review of these suggested that on average there's a prevalence of about 18% of adolescents reporting a history of at least some NSSI. So very strikingly high. Average onset thought to be about early adolescence, 12 to 14 years, seems to be much more common in girls than boys, but does happen in boys. And for those people that have sort of a habit or a recurrent NSSI problem, tend to report about 13 incidents over the course of a year, so about one a month. What's going on with adolescents and this behavior? So if we think about the what's happening in adolescence, the significant challenges that adolescents face and during this developmental transition, and then that they may experiment with a range of coping mechanisms, and some of these are going to be maladaptive. Some of them will be adaptive and some will be maladaptive, such as NSSI as an example, but others would be things like substance use, disordered eating behaviors, and there would be other examples. And we know that there's significant changes in the brain during adolescence. So if you look at my brain development and adolescence slide, on the left panel we have the gray matter, or on the left side we have gray matter, on the right side we have white matter. So on the top for the gray matter, we're seeing the neurocellular changes from birth to mid-adolescence. So the beginning of life, very sort of sparse neural projections and connections, changing rapidly to 6 years to be quite a dramatic change with much more dense and rich complex connections. And then kind of between in the next 8 years, really kind of thinning out, pruning, we think, selecting those connections that are most efficient, most helpful and most used, and that we think that's contributes to efficiency. And then right below that, we see the brain volume change over across age. So we know that brain volume increases during, gray matter volumes increase during childhood, and then they peak around early puberty, and then they start to decrease across adolescence. So again, we think these gray matter changes are reflecting the selection and pruning of useful connections going on as a backdrop during adolescence. White matter, however, is more increasing linearly all across childhood and adolescence and into early adulthood, and we think that those increases are reflecting changes in white matter that contribute to improvement in synchrony and integration. So the refinement of neural connections is ongoing through adolescence.
Question that came in. What does gray matter in general do versus white matter? What does it generally handle in the brain?
So thank you. So if you think of a neuron, the cell, we think of gray matter as primarily like the neural cell bodies, and then the white matter is the covering of the axon. So the gray matter being kind of more in charge of actually deciding what's done in the brain, and the white matter being the substrate for connecting one neuron to the next. So the white matter being a way of looking at communication. The reason I bring up these changes is that because of the fact that NSSI and other mental health problems seem to emerge during adolescence, it seems like the neural structures are more vulnerable to insult and following an abnormal trajectory. So maybe that's part of why things emerge in combination with these developmental challenges that I talked about. But it also might be that the system is more amenable to change from intervention to restore a healthy trajectory. So I think it's really important to focus in on neurobiology in adolescence to better understand it and to see if we can make a better difference. So it turns out that NSSI is associated with a number of problems. We know that it's associated with certainly borderline personality disorder and other personality disorders, of course depression, anxiety, substance use disorders are common amongst people with NSSI, so our eating disorders, various behavior disorders like oppositional defiant or conduct, And then it's certainly present in autism spectrum disorders. And then there's other adolescents with NSSI that don't necessarily meet criteria for any mental illnesses. And I think the important point here is that it's a behavior that cuts across diagnoses. And perhaps that's an important thing to keep in mind when we approach the neurobiological questions, looking at things from a more dimensional way of a perspective as opposed to categorical within diagnosis. Also, with this behavior, there's several time course considerations that I think are really important as we think about the neurobiology. So I have two time course slides. The first one is the large scale, kind of an overall sort of lifespan issue, where on the left we kind of have these risk factors. So here would be like maltreatments, just child abuse, genetic vulnerabilities, having a reactive temperament, being bullied by peers, having worries about sexual orientation, having drug use, and then actually having friends that self-harm is a risk factor. And these are just a few. There are other known risk factors occurring earlier in life. And then you have your onset of NSSI, and then there's a number of factors that are going to be present to maintain the behavior, to make it so that it's something that's hard to give up, a habit or a coping skill that is difficult to sort of recover from. And these would be things like ongoing peer rejection, ongoing family conflict, lack of healthy coping skills, and a number of others. And then, again, across the backdrop of this is neurodevelopment. And then the next slide is on a more small scale, so more of a per-episode time course. On the left, typically you'll have some type of trigger, or a negative event such as a conflict or a perceived rejection or something like this that leads to kind of a negative emotional state, such as sadness, anxiety, guilt, feeling lonely, feeling alienated, or hating oneself. And then the self-injury episode occurs right after that. And then this kind of leads to an improvement in the emotional state, a feeling of relief or calm. And so this kind of provides a structure for us to think about what's happening in the neurobiology. Researchers have been very interested in really trying to better understand what's the function of self-harm, because if we could get better understand this, we could know what's maintaining this behavior. And so Nock proposed this four-function model, and other work has supported it, where there's really two dichotomous dimensions. The behavior is either positively reinforcing or negatively reinforcing, and it's either automatic or intrapersonal within the person, or it's social or interpersonal. So, for example, if you look at the four blocks at the top left, the automatic positive reinforcing would be like having a sense of reward or gaining a sense of reward or pleasure after an episode of NSSI, for example, or gaining a sense of control. And then in the top right, and some people believe this to be the most common, would be like the automatic negative reinforcement. So the episode relieves tension and ends a feeling of, you know, other negative feelings such as depersonalization or something like that. And then the bottom left is that there's like this positive interpersonal mechanism where the person might gain sympathy or attention, or it might help them set boundaries with others, whereas the bottom right is like it removes some type of interpersonal demand. So this way of thinking provides, again, some structure to how we might approach the neurobiology. So next I'll talk about...
Can I interrupt you for just a second?
Yes.
Excuse me if I don't get this entirely clear, both on the questioner's part and for you. Are these functions exclusive, that is, with a person would only have one function at a time, or can they operate?
I think that's a great question. I believe that in Nock's model, he I don't think it's supposed to be exclusive. It's simply a way of looking at these. It's a way of categorizing these different sort of contingencies, and it might be. So, for example, I had said. There's some people have suggested that this negative reinforcement, automatic interpersonal, is perhaps the most common. So most frequently people feel some type of negative affect, and then they feel relief at the end. But that doesn't mean that some of these other things aren't also going on within the individual. And it might be that these other boxes are quite important for other. So there might be like different subgroups within the large group of people with NSSI that could be sort of mapped out in this chart.
Okay.
Was there another question?
I'm trying to. Would the function be a target of treatment intervention?
I think that's been one of the main arguments for really trying to better understand the function. So, for example, if the main function is to relieve tension, then the focus of treatment can be let's develop other techniques that can help you relieve your tension. If the function is more of an interpersonal, function, then in therapy, the person can focus on, more adaptive strategies for getting interpersonal needs met, for example.
Okay, it sounds good. I just want to tell our listeners that if, as you think about it, if you want to follow up on this, do send it in and we can cover it at the end.
Sounds good.
Okay, thank you.
I'll briefly talk about some of the neurobiological work that's been done in the past. There's been a wealth of information, lots of papers on NSSI and sort of the psychological dimensions, and we're starting to get a much better understanding of it, but there's less known about the neurobiology. So different techniques have been starting to be used, so brain imaging, physiological assessments, so looking at things like cortisol or heart rate or defensive startle, or the electrodermal skin response, and then looking at neurocognition. So with the brain imaging, there's been actually a number of studies that I won't have time to talk about here that have been looked at in adults with borderline personality disorder and NSSI. But I wanted to focus in on the studies that really just focused on NSSI regardless of the diagnosis. There was an early study with PET imaging that looked at serotonin binding, 5-HT binding, and found reduced 5-HT binding in the prefrontal cortex of adults with NSSI, and these were unmedicated adults. And more recently, there was a fMRI study in adolescents with NSSI, mostly unmedicated, where they showed them pictures related to NSSI, and these stimuli were associated with greater activation in several areas in the patients versus controls, and these included the orbitofrontal cortex, the inferior and middle frontal cortex, which were greater in activation versus control. So starting to get some understanding of what might be different and related to the behavior. Some more physiological studies have been done in teens with NSSI, especially focusing on, on the behavior as opposed to the diagnosis, with some somewhat mixed results. So one study looked at cortisol, and they actually found diminished cortisol in response to a stressor as opposed to elevated. Another found greater subjective emotional responses, so higher reports of feeling upset, but blunted defensive startle modulation by emotion. So both of those studies suggesting perhaps a blunting in physiological response. Another study looking at the electrodermal response during resting conditions found attenuated response, but another one did find elevated during frustration. So that one is a bit mixed. And then one study did find greater sinus arrhythmia during negative mood induction in a group of parasuicidal adolescents. And that was that they called it parasuicidal. That combined ones with NSSI and also ones that had a history of suicide attempt. in terms of neurocognition, impulsivity has been associated with non-clinical patients who engage in NSSI. One study that looked at adolescents who had NSSI found that they had two categories. One was high severity NSSI, and those kids had impaired spatial working memory, whereas those with low severity NSSI showed impaired inhibitory control, so somewhat supporting this previous observation that impulsivity is associated with NSSI. And another study looking more at sort of interpersonal cognition, social cognition, found that youth with borderline traits may tend to hypermentalize or excessively and inaccurately attribute others' thoughts and feelings to others. So some early evidence for what might be going on in the neural circuitry of young people with NSSI. So we have a few questions. So moving forward into our current research, we have a couple of main questions. The first one is, what are the developmental neurobiological underpinnings of adolescent NSSI? And our work has been focused on looking at neural circuitry using brain imaging. And our approach, again, is to look not at a category of illness, but at this behavior, and to try to draw from the Research Domains Criteria Project, or RDoC, to look at domains of functioning. So our challenge was to then identify some psychological dimensions relevant to NSSI that could be mapped more directly to neural systems. So this next slide that's titled Brain Behavior Relationships is complex, and I really drew from the NIH RDoC website to really see what the systems are that people are thinking of, the domains, the constructs, and the brain circuitry. And so I have three columns: the psychological construct, the system, and then the brain areas that are implicated. And in the proposal for these funding sources, we said we wanted to focus on emotion regulation as the primary system we were going to look at. So we had the most evidence based on others' work and also our own that this would be implicated, and we know the circuitry that's implicated. It has a lot of face validity. We will look at emotional reactivities, coping skills, and things like alexithymia, or the ability to name emotions, which is relevant for emotion regulation. But we said we'd also explore some of the other systems. So, for example, reward seems to be important for at least some people with NSSI. And relevant for positive reinforcement, and certainly for habit. Another system which is probably very important is the social brain. So the way we perceive others, the way we perceive ourselves versus others. And the constructs there would be things like rejection sensitivity, having a low self-esteem, peer connectedness has been another construct of interest with NSSI, and also just mentalization, so that hypermentalization that I mentioned earlier, over-identifying with others' thoughts and feelings. The other systems that are potentially implicated would be default mode network. There's been a lot of interest in that circuitry that's been implicated in things like rumination or self-referential processes. Cognitive control is implicated in, would be the system that encompasses like impulsivity. And then the pain system, because patients with NSSI seem to have altered sensitivity to pain compared to people without NSSI. So these are kind of the overall things that we're interested in looking at, but once again, we're starting out, our first step is to focus on the emotion regulation system. The second research question is, does treatment with N-acetylcysteine, or NAC, reduce NSSI in adolescents? And since we're in the position to, we're already looking at brain imaging, we're able to incorporate neural circuitry assessment into the clinical trial. So we can then answer the question, does NAC impact brain circuitry? Does it restore normal functioning in adolescents with NSSI? So what is NAC? So N-acetylcysteine is a derivative of the amino acid L-cysteine. has complex mechanisms of action, which I won't have time to fully review, but seems to be implicated in impacting glutamate transmission, establishing oxidative balance, so reducing deleterious oxidative damage, implicated in inflammatory pathways and neurotrophins, so molecules that help restore health kind of in a more global sense to the brain. And this medication, the reason we thought to try it in this population is that it seems that we people in here at the University of Minnesota, among others, have found success in research studies looking at addiction, gambling, OCD, hair pulling, some of these disorders that have impulsive compulsive type behavior related to them. And we thought, well, maybe this would help in some of these in NSSI, which also has impulsive compulsive type habit component to it. It's also, I've realized since then that it's also been shown to be effective in some other mental health disorders like schizophrenia, bipolar, and autism. And I'm starting to think maybe it's one of these medications that can just have sort of a more global sort of beneficial effect to the brain. So yes.
Okay. Is this like maybe like a statin that is kind of, you know, put in the drinking water that is low cost, low risk, multiple benefits that would be freely used?
I mean, possibly. I mean, it is a low risk, I think, and but it's too early to say how much of a benefit it is. So there's the studies, like for example, for NSSI, we're still so early, and I would say that the promising studies looking at psychiatric disorders need replication and before we put it into the drinking water, but it does seem to be low risk, and it's for example, it's wild. You can just buy it in a general health store. they sell it over the counter. So in that sense, possibly yes. Did you have another question, Jim? Okay, I'll keep going.
Yes.
So I'll share with you next our work in relevant populations that prompted us to use these methods in the proposed study. So we've looked at brain connectivity in adolescents with major depression and in adult young women with borderline personality disorder. This adolescent depression study was the pilot data that allowed that served as the base for my current K23 award that Jim mentioned in the introduction. So we looked at brain connectivity using two methods. Diffusion tensor imaging is a way of looking at white matter and structural integrity, and we found lower structural integrity as indexed by fractional anisotropy in adolescents with major depression between the subgenual anterior cingulate cortex and the amygdala. And we chose these two areas because they've both been implicated in other work in major depression. So we wanted to look at the connection between them. And we interpreted this as the connection between these areas perhaps is a neurodevelopmental substrate for the diminished capacity to regulate emotion in these young people. And then we also looked at functional connectivity using resting state fMRI. And we again focused on the subgenual cingulate. This has been a really important region for major depression and is the site for example, a deep brain stimulation, if people have heard of that. That's been a more recent technique for example, severe and refractory depression. But anyway, we studied deep brain we studied subgenual cingulate functional connectivity and found a lower connectivity in this network, which encompassed the rostral anterior cingulate and areas of the frontal lobe and also the insular cortex. So once again, kind of interpreting this as lower functional connectivity within frontal limbic networks in adolescents with major depression, perhaps as a substrate for their diminished capacity to regulate emotion. The other study that we wanted to draw from was our one on borderline personality disorder. This was young adults with borderline personality disorder, another imaging study. And this audience is probably familiar that individuals with BPD have high sensitivity to emotional stimuli and strong reactions that are slow in returning to baseline. And previous fMRI work had detected elevated amygdala responses to stimuli and diminished prefrontal cortical activity to threat stimuli. So the current work wanted to dig down a little deeper and try to understand the pathway, these amygdala pathways. So work with animals by Ledoux and others have shown two different pathways. So the short route, we can refer to as bottom-up processing, is like direct connections between the thalamus and amygdala. And this is thought to allow for a rapid response to potential threats in the environment without having to go through the prefrontal cortex, whereas the long route, the more top-down, are connections between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala and allows for a more slower, cortically-driven, interpretive aspects of emotion or processing. So this experiment had actually three different fMRI experiments, one where the participants just looked at neutral faces, one where they looked at masked fear faces, and that was thought to get at masking allows you to kind of get at these subliminal processes and hopefully tap into that short pathway. And then they are also shown overt fear faces in the third experiment, and that was thought to get at this more long pathway of amygdala processing. So the results suggested for the neutral scan, we found lower connectivity between amygdala and sort of this posterior frontal area, the posterior cingulate in patients versus control. So they had lower connectivity, which is kind of what we expected. But for the masked fear connection experiment, we actually found higher connectivity between amygdala and thalamus. So remember, this was the short pathway, which is amygdala to thalamus. And we're quite surprised to see this. We looked across the whole brain, and it was exactly the thalamus that popped up, but it was actually the BPD group greater than the control, so they had a stronger connection in response to subliminal threat. And then to the overt threat, the patients, again, had the higher connectivity versus control, but it mapped onto the long pathway, so amygdala to prefrontal cortex. So we found these results to be very interesting. We really wanted to see, okay, would we see a pattern like this in adolescence earlier on in development, and would we see it not just in borderline patients but in patients specifically with NSSI? So that brings me to finally start to describe our current work, which is supported by these two different grants, and has these two aims, but we kind of encompass it all into one big study. So we invite adolescents 13 to 21 to come in for a comprehensive clinical assessment. They're invited to do an MRI and then to participate in the treatment. Now, some will choose to just get they just want the MRI scan, or some just want the treatment, and then some want both, and that's fine. So the open-label treatment with NAC that we're offering is starting out with 600 milligrams twice a day for 2 weeks, then going up to 1,200 milligrams twice a day, and then going up to 1,800 milligrams twice a day. And then, again, we scan them at the end, and so that way we're able to look at pre-post differences. So to date, we've scanned, we've brought in 15 people, so we're still relatively early on. 13 of those we've scanned. The chart here summarizes really the information on those we've collected brain imaging on for the baseline. So 11 patients and only two controls, so we're really behind in controls. the age of the NSSI group is about 16 and a half, and they're mostly girls. Eight of them have completed treatment, and seven of them had a post-treatment scan. So one of the young ladies actually in the study that did the treatment had braces, so she was excluded from getting the MRI. That's a common problem with teenagers, so that's something that I'll deal with my whole life, I'm sure. So the assessment measures include, we have an, obviously it's quite a list, and we it takes several hours to do so. We really are grateful to our families for kind of going through this with us, but we're trying to collect as much information we can to really get a good sense of these different dimensions. So we first collect information about the self-harm. So we use the deliberate self-harm inventory and the inventory of statements about self-injury. We screen for psychopathology using either the KSADS for the people 17 and under or the SCID for the people 18 to 21. We use the BDI, Beck Depression Inventory, to look at depression levels. We're using the Disturbance and Emotion Regulation Scale to really, again, that was our dimension that we really wanted to focus on, and we wanted to be able to map on to the circuitry. And then more broadly, we're collecting Symptom Checklist 90, looking at impulsivity with the Broad Impulsivity Scale. We included the Toronto Alexithymia Scale, and looking at personality assessment with the PAI. And then finally, looking at reward with the Iowa Gambling Task. So our MRI protocol is kind of, again, complex and long. It takes about an hour and a half. So these kids are very, they're quite good with the scan. They seem to enjoy the testing and the experience of being in our imaging center. They're surprisingly tolerant of the scan. So we collect a high resolution T1 anatomical scan. We're collecting resting state fMRI and diffusion tensor imaging to kind of again replicate the findings that extend the findings that I shared with you earlier from adolescents with depression to see how things might be different in this newer group of adolescents with NSSI. And then the task fMRI, we're again looking at the overt fear and the masked fear, wanting to see if these findings, again, that we found in the BPD group are present here. And we added a matching task, it's called the Hariri task, where people match either emotion faces or neutral shapes. And finally, we're also looking at spectroscopy. So we're able to, in a certain area of the brain, collect concentration of certain neurochemicals and metabolites. So I wanted to just briefly share, too, that we're so lucky to be where we are at the University of Minnesota, which happens to be one of the sites of the Human Connectome Project. So at our site, being led by Camille Ugerbill, have just made some fantastic advances and really wonderful, which allows us to collect data that is much higher spatial and temporal resolution than previously possible. So the data that we're collecting in this study, and in fact, this is one of the first studies to really roll out the connectome advancements in a clinical study. So really lucky with that. And so for example, with the fMRI, our voxel size is 2x2x2 millimeters, and that's just a decrease in size of over about sixfold, which is vast. And then the also the temporal resolution, so between each volume that we collect, is only 1.32 seconds, which is much much faster than previous. And that's really important for just collecting more data in a timely manner. And also it allows us to deal with some of the noise that's inherent to resting state fMRI. For the diffusion tensor imaging, we're able to feasibly collect a larger amount of directions. And this, to simplify it, allows us to look at very sort of tortuous and so windy and small and delicate deep fiber connections that are of interest to us in these neural circuits that we couldn't use before because of limitations of the technique. So as I showed you earlier, we really only have two controls, so I'm not able to share with you any group differences. But what we do have some early data on is just our early experience with the NAC treatment. So we had 8 subjects so far completed the NAC treatment. And interestingly, everyone has tolerated the medication well. We were expecting to see some side effects such as nausea, or some type of GI distress. And no one's actually complained of that as yet. So that's been really great. We don't have any results. I don't have results to share with you yet on our primary outcome measure, just because it simply wasn't ready. So I apologize for that. But anecdotally, most subjects are seeming to find it to be helpful. Our staff are reporting they're either reporting decreased or a cessation of NSSI during the study, with one glaring exception. One of our young ladies really didn't change much at all as a result of the treatment. And one of I'm just going to share with you a couple of quotes. One young lady told me, "It helped with my mood swings," which isn't something I was expecting to see, but glad to hear it. And another young lady said, "It decreased my urges to cut," which is what we were looking for. So although I don't have my primary outcome measures, I do have my some secondary outcomes. So I have the Bratt Impulsivity Scale, and I was able to look at the SCL90 pre- and post-results on our 8 people that finished. And saw some encouraging early things. So the impulsivity scale seemed to indicate a definite decrease in impulsivity after the treatment. And of the subscales, the attentional one seemed to be one that was significant as well. For the SCL90, we saw a decrease in somatization. We saw a decrease at a trend level in hostility and a trend level in just overall SCL90 symptoms. So these results are, you know, very early, but encouraging. They seem to be going in the right direction. For spectroscopy, we only had, unfortunately, we're collecting good data. We're confident that as the study goes on, we'll be able to really share how the medication impacts neurochemicals in the brain. But at this point, we really only had good data on 3 subjects pre- and post-treatment to share with you, and we didn't find any group changes related to time. But this is just showing you the voxel that we're collecting. It's in the anterior cingulate cortex, and then one person's spectra where this is how we calculate the concentrations of neurochemicals in the brain that are relevant to brain functioning. So the final result that I will share, we haven't gotten to the connectivity analyses at all, but this slide shows it's the initial fMRI results. So we're seeing, with the emotion matching task, we saw that patients have greater activation in the assertive anterior cingulate and posterior cingulate areas before the treatment than they do after the treatment. So, and this was only with 7 people, with the significance set to Z of greater than 2 and the cluster corrected P of 0.05. So I was very pleased to see this initial result showing that there seemed to be an impact on response to negative emotion as a result of the medication. So that's really all I'll share with you today in terms of our study. In my last minute or two, I'll share with you where we think this research is going to take us. So for our first research aim of just looking at neural circuitry of NSSI, we're thinking that our next steps will be to look at a larger sample to better understand the biologically based heterogeneity in adolescents with NSSI. So, for example, it may be that emotion regulation is a system that's implicated across all subjects, but it may be that reward is implicated in only some, and that the social brain abnormalities are going to be present in only a subgroup. So to really get an understanding of subgroups that are neurobiology-based, we will probably need a larger group. We also really want to look at changes over time. So starting out with this cross-sectional study, but we want to look at before onset, across episodes, across development. So incorporating a longitudinal design to the neural circuitry question. And then for the treatment question, I mean, obviously this is an open-label study. We would need, if it indeed is promising result, we'll need to follow it with, of course, a randomized controlled trial for adolescents with self-harm. And using the results of the current work, we would love to power the study to identify neural predictors of treatment response and identify changes with successful treatment. So using kind of with this whole program of research, moving toward the neurobiology-based personalized treatment approach. So with that, I'll just acknowledge my wonderful collaborators and my funding sources. And I think it's 7:45, so I'll open up for questions.
Well, thank you so much for this just exciting preview of results that are going to come. I've got different comments and questions here that are pouring in. One suggestion was maybe instead of braces, a criterion for inclusion should be that the kids have Visalign?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, Visalign, I guess, is a different type of braces, not metal, plastic.
Oh, is there some type of braces that are not metal?
Apparently.
Wow.
It's a suggestion that if you had an inclusion criteria of Visaline, that would work. You wouldn't have a problem.
Thank you. I love that idea.
Yeah, right.
I need to write that down.
We've got quite an audience here, and I want to be sure that I'll save these. Don't let me get off. I've got two comments here that I've got to be sure that are just perfect for the conclusion. But, by the way, for the first grant, to my knowledge, that used an RDoC approach, the Research Domain Criterion Initiative for a major symptom of borderline personality disorder. So you're really breaking a path here.
Thank you.
And you're also nicely illustrating the importance of a senior investigator getting a newer investigator interested and involved in the area, how important that is to build the field. Okay, on question here. Frontal cortex and amygdala. Are you looking at the relationship there, or are you looking at that? Because we do have an R01 in New York where the investigator is looking at that, testing mindfulness and some other things to see if you will, he can increase the frontal cortex control or checking of the amygdala.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, so we're interested in resting state connectivity between those two areas, structural connectivity. We're interested in just how do those brain regions activate in response to threat. And we want to see how that circuit changes over the course of treatment and over the course of time. Yes, absolutely. That's really the core circuitry that in our proposal that we, because that's kind of the one that we know most about. And I'm so excited to hear that someone's looking at that with mentalization. Is that with, I guess I can't really talk to the person individually, but is that with, did they say, with adolescents?
Adults. I'll send you the grant information.
Great.
It's a big R01 because it seems like it's right up the alley. Another question, are you going to test a placebo?
That is a future direction. Right now we are just doing a very simple open label study and just wanted to get some initial idea of is this helpful, is it not, and I think just at least based on our early experience, I think we probably will initiate a second phase where we'll be able to test the treatment versus placebo, but it's not up and running yet.
Right. You touched on this a little bit as winding up with this supplement, but people are interested in kind of really how you wound up versus some of the established prescription medications. It's kind of an unusual choice because, it precludes. Effectively precludes a pharma company helping to support the research.
Right. This actually, it was really interesting. I mentioned to you, Jim, before this started, Kaz Nelson, my colleague, is interested in borderline, and it was actually her study. She wanted to try it out in adolescents with self-harm, totally based on our, at the time, John Grant was in our group, Dr. Seokwon Kim, they both conducted studies looking at N-acetylcysteine in these other disorders like skin picking and addiction and gambling and finding positive results. And so just kind of conceptualizing it as a low-risk, novel treatment that's been successful in some of these other disorders that are sort of impulsive, compulsive type, and maybe it would help. And yeah, there was no funding, I mean, except for just a teeny funding because she started it when she was a resident. And so it just was very grassroots. And it was it happened to be that I was interested in the brain imaging, and it was right around the time that I was working with Dr. Schultz and his borderline fMRI and seeing these neat connectivity pathway differences with the fear, overt and masked fear. So we just thought we should really incorporate the imaging into the trial, and so that's kind of how the two things came together.
Yeah, you don't happen to recall how Grant and Kim got into this, do you?
Just and how why they started out with testing and I don't know. That's a great question. I don't know, but I think there was a recent review TIPS, TIPS, by Michael Burke and colleagues, just a really nice review called The Promise of N-acetylcysteine in Neuropsychiatry, and just reviewed a large number of studies that have tried the medication in a bunch of different disorders. So it's quite interesting, and I think hopefully it will lead to some gains, but I think it's a little early to say, and certainly a little early, as the caller said or suggested earlier, to put it in the water.
Right. For our listeners, if I didn't get this right, let me know. I'm just telling them. There's been a lot of variability found in the contents of supplements. Are you using a standardized or one with quality assurance that you know exactly what you're getting?
That's a great question. I think I don't. We use a certain one that that Kaz Nelson recommended. I think that it's the only thing we could really control was that we stuck with the same company. I agree with that. That's probably an issue, and because we weren't initially funded by a drug company, we were kind of just buying it from the GNC ourselves. That was all we did. We're just buying. We did have a certain company, and I apologize. I don't have it in front of me right now.
Well, I don't know that we want to recommend a particular company, but
right.
Keep wondering about that.
Yeah, I think it was more us just picking one and sticking with it.
Right. Could you say a little bit more how people, adolescents, get into your study or get to it?
Because sure. That's a great. I mean, we're always trying to figure out more ways to reach out to adolescents because it has been a little bit challenging to recruit. I mean, right now we simply post flyers, and we've been trying to reach out in other ways in the community. If callers are interested, I mean, I'd love to have them contact me. I have got my contact information on the last slide. I'd also be very open to any suggestions of getting the word out, because usually when they find out about it, people with this issue are very interested, but it's just reaching the right people.
Yeah, certainly here in the Washington area, man, the self-injury prevalence among adolescents is apparently soared, and the people
I know
schools are really
flowing through.
What's going on, and what do we do? And
yes,
but it would be outpatient treatment, so folks would have to be within a reasonable in Minneapolis, St. Paul, or reasonably close by.
Yes,
I can anticipate this question is. would there be any off-site or distance collaboration? Well, you couldn't do the imaging, so that would kind of really limit, but you could do some treatment effects with the paper and pencil measures.
I think that would be great, because especially if we move into a placebo-controlled trial and we'd need larger numbers, I think that would be important.
Okay, and have I covered everything here? Come up. I think I have. I will give a last call chance here for people to, if they have a burning question or wanted to follow up on something, and while the, give that opportunity, I want to mention the two comments that came in that I want to do here toward the end, was another super presentation. Love the work people are doing with adolescents. I think for investigators, the hope that you all give with encouraging results is really important, particularly with this disorder where it's generally been viewed as so hopeless and, well, that's essentially it, so hopeless, and you're just going to be confined to internal suffering. And a compliment about your organization. Love Colin's organization.
Oh, wow, thank you.
We have a very appreciative audience as well.
Oh,
and
gosh.
I got one. No, we addressed the question of how they picked the supplement to use. So that's, I think we've covered everything.
Okay, great.
And I gave a last chance. I had a repeat on how you picked the supplement, but that was from interacting with colleagues who were using it for gambling and having an addiction and having some success, so it seemed like it might carry over.
Yep.
And with that, hey, we're made it with a minute or two to spare. And I
great.
Covered everybody.
Thanks, everyone, for hanging in there with me. It was, like you said, a meaty presentation.
Well, it's a good preview. And I think it's – actually, we've had several people that have given previews, and it really builds your anticipation that things are happening. You just don't have to wait for 3 or 4 or 5 years to have the full results come out. You can think of how things are in the pipeline.
That's a great idea.
I would get zapped if I didn't do this. This is a toughie. With all the emphasis on the brain mapping initiative?
Yes.
What? This is, oh, wow. What would we really like to do to illuminate the brain that would really help your specific research with the focuses?
I'm sorry. So the brain mapping initiative... And what would we like to do to illuminate the brain with my...
Yeah, the big focus, I'm going to inject something here, the big focus that people are hearing about is work on new technology and methods and so forth. So I think the question is, what would you like to have improved in illuminating these brain connectivities and other functions that would really help this particular research?
I mean, I just think that this is a perfect time to really... To be starting this and expanding it, because, like I said, this study that I'm rolling out now is the first time, like, these new connectome techniques are studies in which these connectome techniques are being used here at the University of Minnesota for a clinical population. So we needed to just use them, see what's going on in the brain in the clinical populations, perhaps in parallel with the connectome project and the brain mapping, which are really, one of the goals is to understand the brain in the non-diseased brain, the normal human brain, and then be able to use that as a point of departure for the different mental health illnesses. I think it's a great opportunity to start now applying the new advances in clinical populations and see if we can get some new answers.
Okay, well, let that be the last words. Thank you so much for giving up your Sunday evening.
You're welcome.
And having the family adjust all this. This was just a very wonderful and uplifting and exciting presentation. So,
thank you for inviting me, Jim, and it was fun.
And thank you to both of you.
Thank you so much, Terry.
And bye-bye all. Tune in next Sunday. for some words from work out of Harvard's McLean Hospital. So everybody have a great week.
You too.
Thank
bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.